Chats, a show where I, Josh Pickford, founder of Bear Metrics, give my founder pals a ring to talk shop and stick my nose in their business. This week, I chat with Aaron Epstein, founder of Creative Market, which is an online marketplace for design assets like icons, photography, illustrations, etc. In this episode, we talk about Creative Market's origin, their growth and acquisition, building communities, Y Combinator, design, and a whole lot more. Let's jump in.
Hey, Josh.
Aaron, how's it going, man?
It's going well.
Right on. Right on. So how are things? Are you in California?
I am in California.
Where in California?
I'm an East Coaster, but following the acquisition of Creative Market, moved out to San Francisco a little over 2 years ago now.
Nice. How do you like it?
It's good. You know, we did Y Combinator out here at the beginning of 2010. And I'd probably been back and forth every 6 weeks or so after that until I moved out. So moving out here really was just like I booked a flight without a return ticket for the first time. So,
well, that's cool. What part of San Francisco are you in?
So we work kind of near the Ferry Building is where the Creative Market offices are. And I live up in Russian Hill, so a couple hills away.
Yep, yep. Cool. Cool. Well, so how are things at Creative Market?
Things are great. You know, we're about 2.5 years into the acquisition by Autodesk. Yeah. And, you know, I always tell the team and I always want for myself, I call it the Sunday night test, which is like you're going to bed Sunday night. Are you like, fuck, tomorrow's Monday, I got to start the week? Or are you like, yeah, like I can't wait to get in? And so for me, like I'm still going to bed Sunday night, excited to come in and keep building the product and working with the team and just love the team that I work with. And I've always told people, I don't know if you probably feel the same way, but one of the best things about being a founder is you get to pick the people that you work with.
Yep.
And so, you know, that's one of the things that just makes my day to day really, really enjoyable.
Yep. Well, it's funny you mentioned the like Sunday night test thing. Cause I mean, I'm very much the same way where, you know, by Sunday night, I'm itching to
right.
get started on the week. And we do, so with my family, like at dinner, one of our little sort of rituals is to ask, you know, everybody goes around the table and says like, what were your highs and lows for the day? And I mean, there's a lot of days where I have trouble pinpointing it. It's just sort of like my high is just like, man, work was great today. You
right.
know, like it's like
right.
all the things.
And yeah.
So I do think that's a great test for really for, you know, any job that you've got.
Yep. And working at Autodesk now since we've been acquired is the first time I've ever had a boss.
Yep.
And I'm almost 35 years old. And so I think you're probably the same way, right? Like you always built a lot of projects yourself and, you know, worked for yourself. And so, yeah, it's great to be able to come in and like love what you do every day. And I think us as kind of founders that haven't really worked for a lot of people don't have a ton of experience with that or working, you know, big companies or other startups or wherever the case may be. It's hard to have that perspective sometimes. And I think it's easy to fall into this trap and like take for granted, you know, how much you actually enjoy working every day.
Yep. Yep. What's that transition been like? I mean, you're a couple of years in, I would say, a lot of founders who go through an acquisition probably the 2 year mark is either an actual legal sort of, you know, my shares have vested kind of thing, or they just kind of get the itch to move on. I mean, yep. What's, you know, over 2 years in now, like what's kind of, how's that transition been? Has it been way different than you thought or what's it been like?
So I have a lot of founder friends that have, they've been acquired and, you know, I've heard just tons of horror stories.
Yep.
And ours has just been an awesome experience. And part of that, we actually had, two offers that we got on the same day, actually wow. Halloween of 2013. And when trying to decide, like, do we want to take any of these or do we want to, you know, keep going as an independent, startup? It was a really tough decision, but one of the main reasons we chose Autodesk is because we felt like it was a really great cultural fit.
Yep.
And you know, even getting in here now, it's been over 2.5 years and, my boss always just said, like, just keep growing and gave us resources to do that.
Sure.
And so, and we have grown, continued to grow really quickly. So I feel like it's been an awesome experience, but I also recognize like that's not everybody's experience. But, you know, my boss, when I came in here, was just, he'd acquired a bunch of companies in the past. And I think had learned from some of those experiences that the best way to like keep the magic and you know, keep the founders engaged and everything like that. Keep the team engaged is really to just let them keep doing what they're doing. Mm-hmm. And so it's really nice from my perspective as a founder, because I don't have to worry about fundraising. Yep. I don't have to worry about, well, if I hire this person, you know, it cuts our runway by X months. And so I can just make the best decisions for growing the business without having to spend time on a lot of that other stuff, which has been pretty awesome.
Are you guys in an Autodesk, like in one of their offices, or do you have your own sort of creative market building kind of thing?
So it's kind of a mix of both. Mm-hmm. When we were acquired, we had a tiny little office. It was like an old Pilates studio that we converted into an office in Potrero Hill in San Francisco. And we moved into, it's Pier 9 out here in San Francisco, which is, it's this big Autodesk, like makerspace. It's like, it's an amazing office. There's 3D printers and like a wood shop and a robotics lab. And like, it's like a creative maker playground, which is really awesome. But we were there for like probably a year and a half after the acquisition. And it just got really crowded there. There were never any meeting rooms available. And there were always tours coming through because it's such a cool spot. So yep. We'd always say we're kind of like circus animals, you know, everybody's always coming through. And then there's a swing conference table that we'd have meetings on, and people would tell us to swing to show people that were coming through. So we had to like do tricks.
Perform.
Exactly. And so it was like an awesome space, but it wasn't the best environment to like actually get work done.
Yep.
So a little over a year ago, we opened up a space, right across the street from there. So it's technically an Autodesk space, but we're one of the only teams that's here. And so it feels, you know, for the most part, like we have this building to ourselves, and it's your like stereotypical startup space with exposed brick walls. Sure. And it was actually one of the only buildings that survived the 1906 earthquake. It used to be like an old seed factory. Okay. So it's a really cool space to work out of. But that's another thing that's really nice that I don't have to worry about is, you know, we like made that move and I just like showed up, and there's facilities people that take care of all this stuff. And we didn't even have to lift a laptop or anything. Right, so that kind of stuff is nice.
Oh, man, I remember it's been, I don't know, it's probably been a couple of years. No, maybe not 2 years, but sometime in the past, like year or something, you posted some, you know, you mentioned the whole sort of makerspace thing. And yeah. I remember you posted, I don't know if it was like some CNC machine or something had like cut out the Creative Market logo or something. Yep. And I'm thinking like that, I would love to have an office in some like legit makerspace.
Yeah. Yeah. We have laser cutters and like these 3D printers that look like refrigerators because they're so massive and super expensive too. But it's like the cutting edge of a lot of that stuff is, you know, there's a lot of really cool things going on here. If you're ever out in San Francisco, come stop by and we'll get your logo laser cut out.
Legit. We've turned one room in our house into like a miniature maker space. So I mean, we have 3D printer and then just lots of electronic stuff. And
nice.
I'm attempting, you know, trying to get my kids to, you know, have that stuff accessible, not force them to, you know, make stuff like a little sweatshop or something, but but you know, to have like these resources available is, to me, is sort of this it encourages making things because the barrier to entry of like making an idea become a reality is much lower.
Yep.
And like to me, like that is sort of a goal, is to, how do I equip my kids to not think like, oh, I have this idea, but I can't make it happen.
Right.
You know,
that's so funny that you mentioned that, because that totally resonates with me of why I got into making websites and the internet.
Yeah.
You know, I remember I was like 13 years old. It was probably 93, 94. And like, it was just the dawning of the internet, and I was learning how to make websites and, you know, coding it in Notepad and everything like that. And I remember the coolest thing was like, I could make a website as good as like Coke, you know,
sure.
But I couldn't make a car as good as Ford.
Right.
But it was something where like, just by myself sitting down, taking the time, because I was in the forefront of learning just like everybody else in the world was.
Yep.
And it was something you could do all by yourself and have this finished product. That was like the number one thing that always drew me to like learning how to make stuff for the web. I don't know if you were
exactly the same way, right? Like, I mean, I was the, you know, GeoCities and Angel Fire and
yep.
Tripod and all these sites, just like staying up all night and hacking junk because you could, right?
Yep.
It was accessible.
How hard it was to get hosting back then?
Oh man, it was insane, right? Domains were like $100. You know,
yeah, and I just remember, maybe it's because like I didn't have a credit card or something like that, but I feel like, you know, there were, everybody used the GeoCities and the Angel Fires and the tripods and all those because like it was a way to get free hosting and like be able to share the things that you were making with the world.
Exactly. Well, I mean, and you know, bandwidth was and the internet connection speeds were so low. I remember, you know, vBulletin used to be huge, where you'd just create some community or something like that. And I remember it was Christmas Eve, and I was going over. We were about to go over to my grandmother's house, and I'm like holding up my parents. And I'm like, I've got to start this 5 megabyte download because it's going to take the next few hours to download this file, so I can get my vBulletin community up and running. But man, those are the good old days. I feel like the hardware side of things. You know, you mentioned you could make a website, but you couldn't make a car like Ford. Well, you know, now the hardware side of things seems. There's so many tools and things like 3D printers and all sorts of CNC machines and laser cutters and all this stuff that are making that stuff in itself much more accessible, like the hardware side of things, you know?
Yep. Yeah, seems like the game is changing as far as hardware, but it's still kind of in the early days.
Right. Well, it's like the early web days to me, you know?
Right. Yep, totally. And, you know, that was the interesting thing to me when we were acquired by Autodesk, and I didn't have a lot of exposure to, like, the 3D printing world. And so my kind of personal vision for, like, where it seemed like it would be based on what I had heard was, oh, maybe in, like, 10 years, it's, like, your regular 2D, like, ink printer.
Right.
You know, it's like you pick out a file and, like, you push a button and then, like, it pops out and it's, like, the Jetsons or something like that. And then, you know, being in here, and I'm sure you see this with your kids too, there's so much more that goes into it. You know, it's like prints don't come out right, and some of it's toxic and needs to be cleaned off. And there's just like, build time is measured in like hours, if not days, sometimes rather than like seconds. And so you see all these different issues. And so, you know, you can see that future that's, I don't know how long, maybe a decade down the line, that's like, okay, maybe you can get to that future where you just push the button and people work out new ways to print faster and more reliably and without using toxic materials and all these other things. So it'll be interesting to watch the evolution.
I think that, you know, one of the really important things to, when it comes to teaching sort of future generations, I guess, is the way that the web, I wish that I could have had the foresight to know that how sort of big the web would become. And, you know, like I was always just sort of poking around for fun, but it was, there were so many things that I could have done it's like, oh man, like just thought through the possibilities and which just was not poking around in my brain at, you know, as a 10-year-old. But now I feel like with kids, it's the important part of that is saying, hey, here's this right now will take a long time. You mentioned the build times, like, well, we're going to print out this box and it's going to take 4 hours. Well, in the future, it won't take that long and you can, you know, you can move through your ideas a whole lot faster. And, the whole future of the merging of software and hardware is super interesting to me.
Yeah. So I don't have any kids yet, but, you know, being somebody who, as a kid, I was always knocking on neighbors' doors and, you know, trying to hit them up to pay me $5 to shovel their driveways or rake their leaves or selling baseball cards and all these other things. I think, and I'm curious if you do this with your kids at all, I would just love like getting my kids into that kind of stuff and helping them, you know, like learn about business and starting things at such a young age. Is that something that you actively do with your kids?
Yeah, for sure. They do it a lot between themselves now. I mean, like trying to broker deals, like, hey, I just got this box of gummy bears. I'll sell them to you for, you know, 5 cents a piece kind of thing. And it's funny, we had a yard sale this past weekend in our neighborhood. And so all my kids got there, you know, had amassed all the junk that they didn't want anymore. And so, and I refuse to tell them how to price things, you know, like if somebody comes up and asks you how much something is, try to sell it to them, right? Like start high and work your way down. Don't just be like, oh, that's a penny. you know?
Right.
So, yes, it's fun to see them sort of working that gland.
Are they just naturally interested, or do you do things to kind of push them towards that?
Right now I probably do more pushing them towards, the sort of creative making stuff, side of things, and less on the salesman sort of like, let's learn how to sell stuff. Mm-hmm. So I think, eventually, yeah, I would love for them to kind of like, one of my kids is just super, really, really talented on the, with art, and, I look forward to her kind of getting to merge the art side of things with, hey, you know what, you could potentially turn this into some sort of business thing too, you know, like, which I don't want everything to be this business venture, right? But I think there's a balance there.
Yeah. My wife was a art and marketing double major, so she
kind of, that's a combo.
Yeah, so it's like you got a little bit of the business side, so you're not just like a starving artist out there, but you know, gets to like follow her passion in the same way too.
Yeah, that's super cool. So you founded a number of other things, and I think our paths probably first crossed when you were doing Color Schemer.
Yeah.
Which is this color picking software for Mac. That's dumbing it down a lot, but I started this tech publication called the Apple Blog, and I don't know if I reached out to ask for like a review copy or something like that. I don't know. But I'm curious. So what's the timeline from Color Schemer? This might've been, I don't know, early 2000s up to, you know, now 2016.
Yeah. I'll take you through it real quick.
Cool.
So I actually started Color Schemer in my dorm room in my freshman year in 1999. And so I had this web design company with some friends, and clients kept coming to us and saying like, hey, can you make us a website? And like, here's our logo. And that was kind of like the only creative that they had. And so their logo typically had like one color, maybe two. And so I had to find these harmonious colors that would go with their logo colors. And so I do this guess and check thing in Photoshop, like probably everybody else does a lot of time, to see what would go well. And I was like, there's got to be a tool out there where I can just give it a color and it'll tell me what colors go with that color. And I couldn't, this was 99. I couldn't find anything, you know, anybody had built anything like that. So I kind of did the research behind it on color theory and, some of the like color conversion stuff for colors on the web using JavaScript. And I was able to build this tool called Color Schemer that was just free online, and give it a color and it gives you kind of like a digital color wheel. And so after doing that, I started getting thousands of people coming to the website because I solved that problem for myself and apparently a bunch of other people too. And I realized that I could make a downloadable desktop version with more features and I could charge people for it. And so I did that and I released the downloadable version. And so by the time I graduated college in 2003, I was making like $1,400 a month as a college student and never had to hit up my parents for money. Yep. And I was like, all right, this is awesome. I'm going to see what I can do with this. And so I just did that full time where I was doing everything for it, basically design, development, any kind of partnerships, marketing, customer support, all that stuff. And I did that for a number of years. And so in 2004, 2005, Darius, who became my co-founder, started colorlovers.com, which was a community for people to create and share color palettes and patterns and stuff. And then he brought our third co-founder, Chris, who's our CTO, on board to help build Color Lovers. And so it's probably 2007. We had known about each other, and Darius said, they were on the West Coast, they were from Portland, Oregon. I grew up in the DC area. And Darius shot me an email in 2007. He said, hey, I'm going to be up in Boston. Do you want to meet up? And it turned out I was actually going to be up there that same weekend for a wedding. And so we got together and we were trying to figure out how to make kind of like a partnership work. And he had this community and, you know, was just interested in growing his community. And I had this software and was just interested in selling more software. But I also had this community component to my software where people could share the color palettes and stuff. And so he wanted me to remove that and, you know, link to Color Lovers instead. And I was like, well, it's kind of a competitive advantage for my software. And we sort of left and we were like, neither of us really wanted to budge to make it work. So we both just kind of went back to doing what we were doing. A little over a year later, Darius went to work at Microsoft and Live Labs on Photosynth. And he was there about a year. And as he was leaving, he hit me up again. He was like, hey, you still doing Color Schemer? So by that time, I'd been doing this probably 8 years by myself. And, you know, I felt like I, you know, was making money and it was a good business and all this other stuff. I could work whenever I wanted. It was kind of your dream, ideal passive income job. But I just got bored because I'd been doing it for so long and felt like I wasn't really growing personally, professionally. I was doing kind of the same stuff and it was so automated. So we got back together and in a weekend just hammered out a deal to merge up our two businesses. Shortly after that, this was probably mid-2009 at this point, Darius sends me a text and he's like, hey, if we could do Y Combinator, would you want to do it? And so I was like, oh man, I'm, you know, we bought this townhouse in the DC area and we had to rent it out because my wife just got a job at the Food Network up in New York City. So we were in the middle of a move and we had to find a place to live in New York City. And I was like, let's do it. Cause these types of opportunities don't come around all the time. So I moved my wife into our apartment in New York and spent a week up there with her following the holidays and then flew out to San Francisco to live with Darius and Chris, and do Y Combinator. And so while we were doing YC, we were trying to figure out how to build this business that we already had that was generating money, probably a couple $100,000 a year.
And this is for Color Lovers, right?
It's Color Lovers and Color Schemer. Okay. So, you know, we're making ad revenue on Color Lovers. We probably had 1 to 2 million members at that point. And then Color Schemer was making money as well, selling software for Mac, PC. We came out with an iOS version during YC. And so we're trying to figure out how to build this into a big scalable business. And so during that time, we had these two paths. One that we were looking at was kind of being like a new Pantone. So Pantone, if you're familiar with them, then they, it's like a panel of experts, which I use in air quotes, kind of get into a room and they're like, the color of the year next year will be fuchsia. And then they put out these trend reports and then everybody in fashion industries and all these other industries get those trend reports. And then they're like, oh, color of the year is fuchsia. We should make our stuff in fuchsia. And then it becomes this self-fulfilling prophecy. And so we're like, huh, we have all these people interacting around colors and palettes, and we could actually identify real-time trends for marketers based on certain demographics that could become a lot more valuable than what Pantone's doing. So we have this color data idea, or there's this marketplace idea where here's people that are just having fun spending a lot of their free time just creating creative content. It's actually really valuable for businesses. And MetLife actually reached out to us later that year because they wanted to buy a pattern that a member had made on Color Lovers for $250 to use on this big Thanksgiving Day wrap on their building across from Bryant Park in New York City. And so we took that $250, we gave it to the member, and we're like, this is it. Like, how do we do this in like a big scalable way? And so we started building a marketplace on top of the Color Lovers community. And then we realized it's actually much bigger than Color Lovers. You know, there's fonts and Photoshop files and stock photos and graphics and all these other things that go into a creative project. And so that's why we decided to create Creative Market as its own separate site and use the Color Lovers community to help market a lot of people over there and kind of kick off the marketplace.
That's super interesting. Like I knew about Creative Market kind of coming out of Color Lovers, but didn't, I mean, that's interesting that you can pinpoint it all the way back to a single sort of pattern and transaction that sort of spurs it off. So when you guys started working on launching Creative Market, I specifically remember the invite system that you guys had done. That, I guess to me, I don't recall that being a super common thing then.
Yeah. So it wasn't super common, but, you know, we saw what some companies were doing, and fab.com was like a big one at the time. They grew really quickly, and part of it was based on this invite program that they had to get people to invite their friends and, you know, earn extra dollars or whatever, credits or whatever. And so we sort of modeled ours after Fab. They were like a really hot company in the design space at the time, and it worked out really well. So for anybody who hasn't seen it that may be listening to this, the program was basically you enter your email into our teaser page. This was before we had launched the marketplace. Well, actually, let me back up really quick. One of the most difficult things with launching a marketplace is this chicken and egg problem. Yep. And, you know, nobody's going to want to come and sell products on your marketplace if you don't have any customers, but nobody's going to want to come and buy if you don't have any products available for sale. So you have to figure out how to scale both of those at the same time. And so what we came up with was this this like invite program where if you come to our teaser page before we launch and you put in your email address, we give you $5 in free credit that you could spend once we actually launched. And then once you would put in your email and you'd gotten that $5 in free credits, we kind of show this progress bar where and gave you tools to invite friends over email or social. And if you invited friends and they came and they signed up to get their free $5 credit using your referral link, then, you know, if you invited like five more people, then you got an extra $10 to spend, and 30 people and you got an extra $50. And then like 50 people that you invited was the highest tier and you get like $200 to spend when we launched. And we saw tons of people that were sharing, and a lot of people actually hit that $50 or 50 referral milestone, which was really awesome. And so between that and we put together this free goods page where you could come and download free products that were available for a limited time until we actually launched, but you had to sign up in order to download those. Between those two things, the viral referral program and the free goods, by the time we launched, maybe 8 months later, we had, I think, over 70,000 people had signed up.
Crazy. So how do you get, I mean, the content part, right? So you mentioned the chicken and the egg thing. How did you guys convince people to produce content?
Yeah, so there's a couple different ways. So when you're small, you have different advantages than a larger company. And so we were competing with, you know, the Shutterstocks and Envatos and all these other people that are out there. And, you know, you can list products there and you can get a lot of sales. But, you know, those, because they were larger, one of our advantages was we didn't have as many people selling on the platform. And so there wasn't as much competition for people to get noticed and get exposure. So that was one angle that we pitched a lot of people. You know, I do a lot of outreach to people that were either selling on other platforms or were just really great designers in general to try to get them on board. And we tell them like, hey, because it's brand new, we can get you a lot more exposure. You won't have as much competition in certain categories and things like that. So we tried to use that to our advantage. We also told people that would give away a product for free that, you know, we'd feature them a little more prominently once their paid products, once we actually did launch the marketplace. So that worked out well too. But, you know, for the seller side, it was really just a lot of manual outreach and getting people excited about it. And then once we had a lot of people signing up through the viral referral program, we could go to people and be like, hey, we've got like 50,000 people signed up, all with $5 in free credits at least to spend when we launch. And do you want to be a part of that? And so that became an easier sell.
How did you guys handle the money side of that? Really cash flowing the credit system?
Yeah. So we didn't know what to expect. So we launched and we had 70,000 people signed up, all of which had $5 in free credits. And so it was both really exciting and really scary at the same time.
Yeah.
Because we had raised maybe $1 million, probably, you know, 7 months before we actually launched. So we had a team we were paying and, you know, all these other things. And then, you know, I was really excited on launch day to send that email to everybody and be like, hey, remember that free $5 we gave you? Well, now we're launched, come back and spend it. And like, who wouldn't take advantage of that? Right. So we sent that email, but at the same time, it's like, well, if everybody spends the $5, that's $350,000 that we're on the hook for.
Substantial.
Right. And it's not like we're swimming in money at this point.
Right.
And so that was kind of scary. And so we sent that email and on launch day. And on launch day, I think we had something like $3,000 in total sales, of which maybe 2,000 of it was credits and 1,000 was actually cash.
So a non-issue.
Non-issue, yeah. And so I didn't know whether to be like happy and relieved right. by that, or like disappointed that like, well, we just sent it out and we could have had 350,000, but we only had 3,000.
Yeah.
But you know, that was the beginning of it, and the beginning of making the shops feel like, oh, people are actually spending money here, and it's worth investing time in this platform.
Yeah. So all the stuff that you've done, I mean, so you mentioned being in school. So what did you go to school for?
I went to University of Maryland. I was a business major.
Okay. So you major in business, but everything that you've kind of done over the past 10 plus years has had some sort of design focus, right? I mean, whether it's the color yeah. side of things or what. So do you consider yourself a designer, or is that you just sort of all, it just all happened to work out that way?
Yeah, so I'm kind of a jack of all trades, master of none, as you know, you may consider yourself and probably a lot of other, especially like solo founders, like, you know, people that have done their own kind of thing. And, you know, I did my own thing for, I don't know, 9 years or something like that before merging with Darius and Chris and growing a team and everything. And so you just get a lot of exposure with that stuff. And so ever since I was designing websites, that was kind of my first exposure to learning about design. And same thing with development and, you know, coding websites, coding in Visual Basic for Color Schemer, coding in JavaScript and PHP for the web. And then eventually, you know, taught myself Delphi, Pascal on PC, and then Objective-C on Mac. Mm-hmm. So I'm a self-taught designer, self-taught developer. And, you know, that's one of the things that I didn't really realize at the time. But I was picking up all these like well-rounded skills versus somebody that, you know, maybe, goes into a big company after college and they're a designer or they're an engineer or, you know, they're whatever the role may be. And they don't get quite as much exposure doing all these other different skills. And so I found, especially as a founder and starting to grow a team, you know, I could speak the language that, that the engineers, you know, spoke. And so I understand if we want to build this feature and, because I have a vague idea of how to do it myself or how I'd go about it, then, you know, I can even help them, think through how to design it and everything like that. And I could give feedback to the designers, in hopefully an intelligent way, you know, rather than somebody that doesn't have as much, experience in that world. And so those skills really turned out to be huge assets for helping to grow the team and being able to communicate with other people in different roles.
I think a common thread that I notice, at least across lots of founders, is the ability to teach yourself something in a relatively short amount of time. Right. And really to even enjoy the process of learning stuff. Right. And I think that's not something that's the case for everybody, right? Like some people have a really hard time sort of grasping new concepts and, or even finding the time to sit down and just figure, something out. And I'm curious I wonder how many designer or, founders would be like a jack of all trade type. I'm sure that's a lot.
I think it depends. You know, our CTO, Chris, like, you know, he's not interested in, you know, the design side or even the product side quite as much. He's just like, you know, super into the tech side.
Yep.
And so for him, it was always kind of like, well, just tell me what to build and, you know, I'll build that. And then, you know, other people are different. And so, yeah, I think it depends on the person, but I would bet that most founders are what you're describing, just in general, and that they're probably, you know, they're learning new things. They're not scared to just dive right in and pick something up. It's never like, oh, well, I don't really have any experience on that, so, you know, I need to figure that out first. It's like, well, we're going for it. And if I suck, then I'll figure it out and I'll learn over time. And hopefully I'll be better 6 months from now than I am today.
Yeah. I remember when I was doing consulting stuff, especially early on, I would always, you know, some client or potential client would ask, hey, do you do this? And I mean, the answer was invariably yes.
Right.
But, you know, 90% of the time I didn't have a clue. I wouldn't even know what they were talking about. Right. But
right.
I'll go figure it out real quick. Right.
Yeah.
Just cause it was fun to do, really.
Yeah. And you make it work.
Right. So wrapping it up, Sir. So what's last thing to talk about would be, so building community. So you've got Color Lovers. And then to some extent, I mean, I would assume you call Creative Market a community, at least in some form or fashion, right? I mean,
yeah, I describe Creative Market as like 75% marketplace, 25% community.
Yeah. Okay. So I guess what's the hardest part of both starting a community and then also maintaining it, like keeping it going and keeping it from turning into just the worst place on the internet.
Right. I think people that run communities, I guess I'll say on the whole, communities are kind of like an in the image of their creators and the people that run them. Mm-hmm. You know, when we were doing Color Lovers, we really wanted to make it an inclusive community and go above and beyond to make people feel welcome there. And sometimes that was almost to like a detriment to the community because, you know, some people would say something crazy or something like that. And it was like, well, you know, we want to be supportive of everybody here kind of thing. And, and that resonated with a lot of people. So it was much more positive than it was negative, but there were always those incidents that would come up and would be difficult to deal with. It's easier when you're starting to build a community, because just as an individual, you just need to be active, and let people see you. You know, you're doing this now in the founder community, and you do this with all the insights that you share through Baremetrics, and your writing and doing this podcast and everything like that. And so you're building a community because you're really visible. And at that scale, it's easier to do that. People see you. They want to be a part of that. You know, you have like a brand that you're portraying, and people that resonates with, they're the ones that are attracted to it. And people that are not kind of in that mold or into that would not be attracted to it. So it gets kind of shaped in your own image. And that's easier when you're smaller too. And so as you start to scale, then, you know, it's probably not enough. Creative Market's almost 5 million members at this point. It's not realistic for any one person to be the community, you know?
Yeah.
And so as we scale, we have to hire people that are kind of represent and embody the vision that we have for the community, and the vision that the community has for itself. And so as the community starts to grow, it becomes less about, you know, one person kind of setting the tone, and more about the community of people that you've attracted from the early days. And that community evolves, and more people come join that are attracted to it. And it becomes more about them trying to, you know, create the home that they always envisioned that this community could be. And so as us, as kind of the keepers of the community, it's really up to us to make sure that we have policies in place and are doing the things, and engaging in a certain way that helps foster that kind of environment. And so for Creative Market, that's just like a really inclusive, supportive community, where we don't tolerate things that, you know, people being offensive to each other or tearing down each other's work or anything like that. And we really want to be a place that that really helps to support independent creators, and where independent creators can feel like they can come and they can learn and they can earn, and they can really feel like they're a part of something that's special. And so everything that we do, we try to preserve that. And yeah, there are certain things that happen where, you know, the community may be upset with something. And ultimately for us, it's for us to determine, did we make a mistake here? And, you know, there's been plenty of instances where we've listened to the community and we'll go back on a policy or change the way we do things or something like that, because we realize, like, you know what, they're right. Or sometimes we have kind of a longer term vision where, you know, it's like somebody gives you a feedback for a product feature or something, and you're kind of like, okay, I hear the specific thing you're asking for, but reading between the lines, what I think you're really looking for is this thing. Yeah. And so sometimes you have to interpret that and make decisions that we think are ultimately in the best interest of the community, given what we know they really care about.
Yep, yep, that makes sense. Well, cool, man. Well, I think that's all that I've got. How can people get in touch or follow along?
Yeah. Check out creativemarket.com. Hit me up at Aaron, A-A-R-O-N, at Creative Market, or on Twitter at Aaron_Epstein, E-P-S-T-E-I-N. So I love doing these kinds of chats. And if there's any other founders out there that, you know, think this was interesting, or, you know, want to ask questions or get advice or whatever, I love being able to give back and help other founders out. So something I'm super passionate about. So if there's anybody out there that's listening, please don't hesitate to get in touch. I'd love to talk to you.
Right on. Well, Aaron, it was good to finally have an actual phone call after years of crossing paths.
Yeah, Josh.
Cool. So, that's all I've got. And thanks for hopping on the call.
Awesome. Thanks, Josh.
Thanks, Aaron.
See ya.
There we have it. Hope you enjoyed it. Check out founderchats.com for a whole pile of other chats. And thanks for listening.